Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
AFA Action takes attacks on the family seriously. The enemies of the family constantly employ new tactics to try to sneak past our radar. They know if we stand together, their evil plans will fail. Your gift to AFA Action allows us to stay vigilant against their onslaught. And if you give this month, you'll receive access to the Cultural Institute video, When Your Faith is Illegal, by Frank Harbor on AFA Stream as our thanks. You can make your gift today at afaaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, May 28th. We're already almost at the end of May. Absolutely crazy how time flies. But in the legal world, we're kind of just continuing to go on and on and on with some of these lawsuits. So NPR and Colorado public radio stations are suing the Trump White House as of yesterday. So this is coming from NPR.org. NPR and three Colorado public radio stations filed suit Tuesday morning in federal court against the Trump White House over the president's executive order that purportedly bars the use of congressionally appropriated funds for NPR and PBS. So the legal filing states, quote, it's not always obvious when the government has acted with a retaliatory purpose in violation of the First Amendment, but this wolf comes as a wolf, that legal filing states. The order targets NPR and PBS expressly because, in the president's view, their news and other content is not fair, accurate, or unbiased. So the lawsuit says the administration is usurping Congress's power to direct how federal money will be spent and to pass laws. It names President Trump, White House Budget Director Russell Vought, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, as well as a few other individuals as defendants. So a team that includes noted free speech lawyer Theodore Boutrous filed the lawsuit for NPR and the Colorado stations jointly. In where? Well, the District of Columbia. Shocking. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, so I think the two issues here mainly are the separation of powers, because the NPR asserts that that only congressional action, once these funds are appropriated, could withhold them or otherwise reallocate them. And so through executive order, that seems to be the threshold question. But then they're also arguing First Amendment retaliation. So does NPR have a case here?
Well, on the First Amendment retaliation, I don't think that it does. I think that that's an argument that it's making because it's, I hate to put it this way, the cool argument that's being made today that everything is free speech and President Trump is violating everyone's free speech with everything that he does. However, the stronger argument is that the statute under which it was founded is unclear. It was meant to be founded in a way that protected it, immunized it from political pressures. But the statute, when Congress wrote this law 5 decades ago, basically didn't clarify how it could be terminated or how it could be suspended or anything along those lines. It provided that the president would appoint members of its board in consultation with Senate leaders of both parties. But it didn't say anything about removing people. It didn't say anything about funding. It left it vague. And because of that, I think that NPR has a good argument here that it can be that it's making.
So, and you're talking about the Public Broadcasting Act. I'm assuming that's in 1967, which established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And this is an independent entity that it essentially shields media from political interference. And so if the action that the Trump administration wanted to take here, I mean, what would be the appropriate action then for Congress to go back and clarify this?
it may well be that it's for Congress to, well, first of all, we have a common trend. We see that a lot of these issues could be resolved if Congress actually wrote proper laws that were more clear. But the second trend is Congress is funding CPB. Congress is funding NPR and PBS. Congress could act to cut that funding. It doesn't need to include it in the budget. It doesn't need to put President Trump in the position of issuing executive orders if these agencies, if these groups, if these organizations are left unfunded. So Congress could be doing a lot more to help President Trump. And with this specifically, it can be issuing, it can be writing clarifying legislation about how exactly NPR and PBS operate under the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and how it's actually controlled. Because right now we have an agency that's set up by an act of Congress, but it's not apparently directly controlled by the executive branch, but nor is it controlled by Congress. So it created this independent monster that's very hard to rein in.
Which sounds a lot like the big bureaucracy that the Trump administration is trying to fight. But this really begs the question then, Gerard, why President Trump is not actively and more publicly urging Congress to have this type of clarifying legislation or actually get their job done. I mean, the only thing that they've really been focused on is this quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, which Rand Paul and Thomas Massey and others, even like former Freedom Caucus Chair Bob Good, are actually saying, you know, is fiscally irresponsible. And there's a lot of controversy over that. But it seems like, okay, you know, that aside, can't Congress do more than one thing at a time? And why, if it is this type of legal posture, I mean, Trump's attorneys, you would think, would know this. Why even set themselves up then to fail by executive order?
Well, they have a very ambitious view that that what they're doing can potentially succeed under executive order, then they don't need to go through negotiating things with Congress. They don't need to ask for help when they can just act unilaterally. I think we've seen that with a lot of Trump's executive orders. He is looking to actually take decisive action because Congress has done nothing for decades, even when it's been under Republican control. So this is why Trump is going the executive order route. He doesn't want to spend the next 3.5 years arguing with Congress over $500 million here and $20 million there. He wants broad, quick action. Now, why isn't he putting more pressure on Congress? That's a good question. That's something he should be doing. Even with this big, beautiful budget bill, it is so simple to not include budget items for things that Trump does not want. Why is NPR, why is public PBS getting $500 million plus when Congress can put in $1? And that would solve the problem because there's no funding for this organization to operate. There's a lot that Congress could be doing, and I think President Trump will be putting more pressure on them because he shouldn't be doing this alone. He needs help from people who voted for him. They also voted for Congress to act on his behalf. On behalf of the American people.
Yeah, and that's such a great point that a lot of this and a lot of these controversies don't even really need to be adjudicated judicially. It would be a far easier and quicker solution for Congress to simply reappropriate and only put in a dollar, as you said, instead of having these publicly funded broadcasting entities that clearly are biased. I mean, I think for conservatives listening to NPR, I mean, I've been in so many Ubers where, you know, that's kind of the station of choice because everyone's like, you know, hey, this is nonpartisan, this is just public radio, but it clearly has a bias and you can see that in their quote unquote reporting. And so why should NPR get taxpayer funding when other conservative biased media doesn't? I think that's a great question. But if Trump is trying to move quickly and deftly and the executive branch, by definition, just really can't on these issues, it seems like somebody should be raising this point to Congress because that's what they literally just did with the budget. And yet nobody is looking at these types of items. Instead, you know, all the media is talking about what DOJ is uncovering and a lot of the maybe more sexy issues. But something like this could have easily been done and that could have circumvented, you know, these headlines. And then it looks like if NPR actually wins, it'll look like, oh, look, Trump is overstepping again. And look, he's the dictator and he doesn't want us to have, you know, First Amendment protected speech. And they'll run to those types of headlines. So it seems like this is a losing posture overall, even in the court of public opinion for the Trump administration, when they're basically handing a significant win, likely, to NPR instead of doing a very quick line item.
And it's a very big, you're absolutely right, and it's a very big propaganda win, because what the public will remember if NPR wins, it's not that federal law was unclear or vague. They'll remember First Amendment, free speech, because that's what keeps being hammered home in every one of these cases. So the general takeaway that the public has is that the Trump administration, and by extension Republicans, are looking to quash free speech, when that's not ultimately what a lot of these cases are going to be decided on. They're going to be decided on process, on procedure, on underlying statutory interpretation. But for the general public, it's, you know, Trump bad. He wants to end free speech, where this speech is free, but it's also, as you rightly point out, very much biased. I think many Americans see the bias there, and they're wondering why our taxpayer dollars are paying for it, why they're not paying for equal time for differing opinions, why we need to have this politicized broadcast in the first place and pretend that it's something that it's not, which is fair and unbalanced.
Yeah, and so Jared Folletti is my special guest this morning, senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And, you know, what should be the solution here? Is it just that taxpayer funding shouldn't go to any media organization? And so, you know, if anyone wants to broadcast their views, they're welcome to do that, but not on the taxpayer's dime? Or should it be that Congress does have that kind of clarifying legislation, and anyone who receives taxpayer funding has to actually report fact, which can maybe get a little sticky? But at this point in 2025, what, in your opinion, is the better policy solution?
I will start by saying that in 2024, I would have said that it needs more congressional action, first and foremost. The problem with that, though, is that there is such a razor thin majority for the Republicans in Congress, and organizations like PBS, like NPR, are very good at, let's not call it officially lobbying because they don't do that, but at influencing and being influenced by politicians, that it will be very hard to get the votes necessary to cut that funding potentially or to change the law. So I think that that's less and less a viable course, although with a budget bill, that's the easiest place to stick in a few hundred million dollars for a pet project and also take out hundreds of millions of dollars for projects like this or like the USAID initiatives that don't belong. Ultimately, it's challenging because media has shifted. We live in a different society where advertising dollars, which used to pay for the operation of radio and television, are simply not there. So all of these stations are looking for more creative ways to fund their operations and increasingly relying on creative ways to get grants from the federal government or get taxpayer dollars. In some cases, it's good. We have small independent stations that are more faith-based, that are more American values, that receive funding. But on the other hand, the behemoths like PBS and NPR, they get a lot more money and they are much more pernicious in the negative influence that they have. What should happen? I think that we have the internet. We have a wide variety of ways of getting media, especially media that's very inaccurate. I think the competitive market means that people put their views out there and let the public choose, not the taxpayer dollars be directed by Congress or by agencies that don't even respond to Congress or presidential oversight.
Yeah, well said. And I think the takeaway for listeners here, if you're frustrated with the lack of action and the significant enduring wins, then you need to be contacting your members of Congress. I mean, the Republicans are in control right now. And if we're not seeing some of these wins, that's directly the responsibility of Congress. And so we can't just look to the Trump administration to get everything done. This has to go through Congress as well. And in just the last few minutes I have with you, Jared Folletti, I wanted to get your take as well on the Supreme Court declining to hear Liam Morrison's case. This is the young 12-year-old who wore a T-shirt to his school that said there are only two genders. And that case was not taken up by the justices. And it was interesting, Justice Thomas dissented from the denial of cert, saying basically that he thinks that Tinker versus Des Moines, which is the controlling case and precedent on this issue. He says that this court held that public school officials may not restrict a student's freedom of speech unless his behavior materially disrupts classwork or involves substantial disorder or invasion of the rights of others. I, Thomas speaking, have previously explained why Tinker's holding is without basis in the Constitution and should be dispensed with altogether. But unless and until the court revisits it, Tinker is binding precedent that lower courts must faithfully apply. So so I think this was a fascinating insight that in Thomas's rationale that he wants to actually revisit that entire line of precedent for free speech. What is your thought on that and the Supreme Court declining to hear this case overall?
I think that we all understand that when it comes to high school, elementary school, that there is not quite the same exercise of free speech that is in the rest of society. And that is because there is a difference when it comes to children. There is that materially disruptive effect on the learning environment, on a child's development, that can happen if you allow completely unfettered speech, including the propagation of dangerous ideas. Imagine if this wasn't about, you know, how many genders there are, but advocating for the terrorist goals of Hamas or Hezbollah. It's same thing. We want to be careful what ideas we want to have freely expressed in K-12. The flip side, though, is that we shouldn't be allowing schools to inform the public what they have decided is disruptive and not, because that may not go with what parents choose. That may not go with what society values. And here we essentially have a school that's saying there's more than two genders, and saying anything differently will potentially harm anyone who identifies as non-binary or whatever they call it. And for that reason, they banned it. It's an understandable decision and justifiable under current law. The problem is we should be looking at the gatekeepers, why the schools are saying these things, and what we can do to change the opinions of these schools so that we no longer find ourselves explaining normal traditional family values and finding that we can't because the schools think that those are harmful for children.
Yeah, and one attorney wrote on social media, Liam's story is clear evidence that it's too early to declare victory in the fight against gender ideology. As long as there are schools in America where students are encouraged to express one view of this topic, that gender is a spectrum, but forbidden from expressing a different view, that there are only two genders, we haven't won yet. Remember, because gender ideology is based on a lie, it relies on censorship to survive. I think that's a pretty apt description of where we're at.
Very apt description, and that's why we have to push back, whether it's through litigation or whether it's through pressure by parents at the school board level. We need to push back. We need the garbage to stop being taught and presented as fact. You know, having the notion that there are multiple genders and not being allowed to contest that, that's a suppression of speech that's more dangerous than any harm that can happen to students if you allow a vivid conversation about it.
Well, well said. Well, we have to take a break here, but Gerard Folletti, appreciate you staying a few minutes over time to opine on the Supreme Court. And, you know, hopefully President Trump will have an opportunity to appoint maybe one or two justices this term that are better, I think, than some of his picks in the first term. I've been, quite frankly, disappointed in particularly Amy Coney Barrett. But, you know, the Supreme Court overall, when they're not willing to weigh in on these things and take the Justice Thomas and Alito route, who I think are standing firm on really the foundation of the Constitution, the principles of liberty. And if they were able to direct the court's posture, I think we would have a lot more wins coming from the Supreme Court. But we're going to continue on the legal track on a Fifth Circuit win for the American Family Association when we come right back right after this. When a woman experiences an unplanned pregnancy, she often feels alone and afraid. So many times, her first response is to seek out an abortion. But because of the generosity of listeners like you, that search may lead her to a Preborn Network clinic. Preborn offers God's love and compassion to hurting women and then provides a free ultrasound to introduce them to the life growing inside her. This combination brings the ultimate miracle of life to life and doubles a baby's chance at life, which is why Preborn saw over 67,000 babies rescued last year alone. Meet Maddie. Maddie was in a tough situation as she wasn't sure who the father of her child was. But after receiving counseling, prayer, and a free ultrasound at a Preborn Network clinic, everything changed. Maddie discovered she had twins and found the strength she needed to choose life. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. How many babies can you save? Please donate your best gift today. Just dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, in a great win for the First Amendment, but also for the American Family Association and the National Religious Broadcasters, the Fifth Circuit sided with the NRB in an effort to protect Christian broadcasters from unlawful employee disclosure requirements. Regular listeners from our AFA family will remember this lawsuit, and certainly you've heard our general counsel, Abe Hamilton III, talk about this quite frequently as well. But recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the FCC had overstepped its regulatory authority by attempting to force broadcasters to report the race, ethnicity, and gender of each of their employees. The decision marks a significant victory for the National Religious Broadcasters, the NRB, which, along with one of its members, the American Family Association, had filed a petition for review of the FCC rule that had reinstated this form collection and disclosure requirement. So for more on this and where the posture of the case is now, let's welcome in Mike Ferris, who is the NRB General Counsel and longtime dear friend and mentor of mine. So Mike, congratulations on this case. I know that, you know, with your involvement, the NRB, of course, is making a lot of headway on this. Tell us a little bit for people who don't know the background of this case and then where we're at today.
Sure, Jenna. Good morning. Under the Biden administration and their dominance at the time of the FCC board, they issued a rule that basically set up radio stations and television stations for doxing. They required everyone to file a form called Form 395 that would require you to disclose, as you said, the sex, gender, and so on, including the sexual orientation was one of the requirements that they were looking for. And the point was to put this on your public disclosure. It would have been a completely different case if they would have just said, we're gathering this for some legitimate purpose. But they weren't. They were doing it so that that would be on a public disclosure form so that gay activists and others could go to this material and then start doxing stations, filing complaints with the FCC. Otherwise, if they weren't meeting the quota standards that the groups were arguing for. So if you can't have racial quotas, that those are unconstitutional, why do you gather data to demonstrate whether or not you're having meeting the quotas, whether it's race, sex, sexual orientation, whatever it is? There should be no quota system. There should be no data gathering. Our country should be a colorblind society and follow that neutral principle in all areas. So it's a great win for freedom, a great win for freedom of speech, and a great win for AFA and NRB in particular.
Yeah, so where does this go from here? I mean, is this going to be appealed, do you think?
I don't think so. I don't think the Trump administration would appeal it. And the FCC with a Republican majority, I don't think they'll appeal it. So, nor I'm sure that the Solicitor General's office would be involved in an appeal. They're not going to appeal. They agree with the outcome, and so it's the case is all done. Effectively it. I think the oral argument was the first week of February, but it was effectively already done before the Trump administration had really an opportunity to dig in on it. So, or the current, appointees to the FCC. So it's, I think we're done and over. I think this is completely finished.
And that's really good. And again, why election results matter, because if the Biden administration had been effectively continued under Kamala Harris and that type of woke ideology, we would see more and more of this push against faith-based organization, Christian broadcasters, and even anyone who just agrees with reality and wants to proclaim truth. And so, why did the Biden administration even think that this would prevail? I mean, is this just yet another type of push to see how much they could get away with?
I think so. I mean, they were looking at a Supreme Court case involving the California Attorney General's office, where they were trying to gather information about donors for a similar doxing kind of purpose, and the Supreme Court had ruled against them. Against California, but the same ideology that controlled the Harris administration, or that would have controlled the Harris administration and did control the Biden administration. So, yeah, I mean, they were staring a very clear Supreme Court precedent in the face, and they don't care. They didn't care what the Supreme Court ruled against them on the student loan forgiveness issue. They just don't care. They keep going after people time and time again and hope that they win some. The Supreme Court will deny cert. Like, you know, you were already talking about the case yesterday with the boy in the T-shirt and the gender ideology. They just keep trying, and some of them fall through the cracks. And they win by their sheer volume of their cases. And they're doing this in a way that, they keep claiming that they're following the rule of law. But I did an analysis. The New York Times has a website that tracks, and as of about 2 or 3 weeks ago when I did this, there were 287 cases that have been filed against the Trump administration. 89% of those have been filed in federal circuits where the majority of the judges were appointed by Democrat presidents. And within the districts, within the circuits, 95% of the cases have been filed in districts where a majority of the judges were appointed by Democratic presidents. That's not following the rule of law. It's showing that this is political litigation that's going on. And so they engage in it in great numbers, regardless of who's in the White House, regardless of anything. You can expect legal warfare from the left. It's been a territory that they've been good at. They've got lots of money. They've got lots of friends. And when they file it in the right districts and circuits, they could wreak havoc for a while. And the Supreme Court has a difficult time. The Supreme Court takes 100 cases a year, period. Well, they got 287 cases going against the Trump administration. Well, you know, some of them are not going to get to the Supreme Court, and they do it in a circuit where they think they can get away with it. So this is trying to rule the country through silencing us, doxing us, suing us. And, you know, sometimes we fight back and we win. We're getting better at that. We're getting more numerous in our ability to put lawyers on the field, to put cases on the field. But, you know, we've got a long way to go.
And I'm speaking with Michael Ferris, who's the general counsel for the NRB, the National Religious Broadcasters. And those statistics are really frustrating, I think, for conservatives who want to follow the rule of law and who are seeing that by sheer volume, this type of lawfare and essentially trying to rule by judicial fiat is practicable for the left, especially when they are forum selecting, as you rightly pointed out. And so as conservatives are pushing back and we're able to do a little bit more, what should the strategy be moving forward? Well, at least for the next few years, we have an administration that is on the side of free speech, of religious freedom, of Christian broadcasters. So at least we don't have the challenges from the Trump administration we had with Biden. But that may only be for the next couple of years.
Indeed. We have to fight fire with fire, and we have to, build up our team. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not conservatives want to have a free country as much as the left wants to have a country that they dominate with wokeness and the oppression that goes with it. The amount of money given to the ACLU and other left-leaning organizations dwarfs the amount of money given to the groups that are litigating from the right, like ADF, where I used to be the CEO. ADF is, nowhere near, even though it's the largest by a long shot of the conservative groups and Christian groups, it's nowhere near the size of the ACLU. And Liberty Council and First Liberty, and, there's a good growing number of groups, but the people that support those groups on the left are much greater with a lot more money, and they fight more fights than we can fight. And so one of the takeaways is that Christians and conservatives need to stand up for their freedom and be willing to go fight in the courtroom, because we cannot prevail in the long haul if they're outgunning us year after year after year.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Ferris, who's the general counsel for the NRB. And do you think that with the limited resources comparatively that conservative groups have, are we going on the offensive enough pushing our issues, or do you see us too often just responding to the left's overwhelming litigation?
Well, I know that the major groups, that ADF and, ADF won a bunch of cases when I was the CEO, and continues to do so, where they brought the case. They weren't defending this 303 creative case that won a major victory for free speech. When free speech is in conflict with gay rights laws, the state and local gay rights laws, free speech won, and that was an affirmative case. So I'm litigating now on behalf of NRB an affirmative case challenging the constitutionality of the Johnson Amendment, which is the rule that nonprofits can't speak out about candidates, which is really, as the IRS has been enforcing it for decades, is a rule nonprofits can't speak out to support Republican candidates. You can say anything you want about a Democratic candidate, and you appear to get away with it from the IRS, but it doesn't work the other way around if it's a Republican candidate that's involved by a nonprofit saying something. So, no, there's a lot of affirmative litigation. Liberty Counsel does that, First Liberty, Pacific Justice, others bring affirmative litigation as well as defensive litigation, but it's simply a matter of volume. The left, there's nobody that's doing 287 cases in the space of 90 days or 100 days like the left has done. And so the amount of resources that takes, because they got the great big major law firms and their pro bono programs on their side as well. And so that's another factor in the whole deal. And so we are outnumbered because simply the amount of resources that the groups have.
And so with the limited resources and offense versus defense, what do you think are the most important issues right now in kind of the foreseeable, maybe just next 3 years of the Trump administration that conservatives need to prioritize?
Well, the censorship that's going on about dissenting from there are 87 genders or whatever the number is this week, that whole thing, the censorship that goes with that, there are cases pending in the Supreme Court over that still, even though the T-shirt case was not taken. There are a number of cases that are on the pipeline of that. And then, so the coercion and the censorship, the forced speech, the silencing, all of that is really important. I think that the case that I'm litigating is, obviously I'm putting a high priority on that because that opens up more freedom of speech for nonprofits to say what they want to say. The examples we put in the complaint of Democrat-leading nonprofit newspapers endorsing candidates and opposing Trump and other Republicans, I think they have the right to say what they want to say, but not one way. The one way area of the law has got to cease. This America needs to embrace the principle. I may disagree with everything you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. That principle is very much worth fighting for, and the freedom of speech is the highest priority. Also, I would say there's an opportunity to finally clarify the free exercise of religion. And we need to get that back on track and get rid of the legacy of the Smith case, which comes from 1990, that where the Supreme Court really did us a great disservice by putting the free exercise of religion as a second-class right. And so that's why the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was necessary. Hobby Lobby won its famous case on religious freedom, not from the First Amendment, but from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And even though I was the co-chairman of the group that wrote that law, and I obviously think it's a good thing, it was always a stopgap measure until the Supreme Court reversed Smith. That's what really needs to happen. So this is on a constitutional basis, not on a statutory basis. But those are two of the highest priorities, I think. But, you know, setting up for parental rights is obviously extremely important as well. And that touches both freedom of speech and free exercise as well. And so the Mahmoud case that's pending in the Supreme Court on a free exercise basis is a really important one. That's another LGBT textbook indoctrination case. That's going on for, this is for, you know, like kindergarten, first grade, second grade. It's just horrible what's going on. And the teachers were told by the school district to disrupt the beliefs of the children who dissented from their woke ideology. And so it's clearly, it's not even a close call whether it's indoctrination. They tell them point blank that's what they're supposed to do.
Hmm. And Mike Ferris, last question for you, and I so appreciate your time and your advocacy for all of these important issues, because as we've discussed, the Supreme Court only takes about 100 cases. We've seen the denial and Justice Thomas's frustration, I think rightly so. Do you think the current Supreme Court composition, at least overall, the majority, not just Thomas and Alito, share the concerns of these issues, that they're going to be willing to address them in the foreseeable future so that we can keep these types of principled liberty on these issues?
They're taking a good number of cases. I you know, obviously think they should take a few more of the major constitutional claims, but, you know, it's so improved from where it was, you know, at various other stages of our country's history. You know, when we had Warren Berger as the Chief Justice, there wouldn't have been two votes, much less two votes in a cert petition. There wouldn't be two votes for the kind of principles that we're talking about right now. It was a bad place for the kind of values that we have. And so the court is so much better, and it's the best that's been in my lifetime. But and that's a pretty long time. I mean, like I'm 73 years old, for instance, you know. But it is it's still got a ways to go. You know, we it's because law schools don't teach originalism. If you don't teach originalism, you're not teaching the rule of law, because the opposite, the living constitution theory, means that judges should be able to substitute what they think the Constitution should mean for what the people who wrote it means, you know, meant by the various points of the document. And so that by itself is the rule of politics. And for people to say we're not following the rule of law when what they want to implement is the rule of politics, therein lies, you know, the deepest problem in the judiciary system. Unless every judge embraces the theory of originalism, what they're saying is judges should write the law the way they want to write it, not the way our Republican form of government has written it, where all legislative authority is vested in the Congress of the United States, and all executive authority is vested in the president, and the court is not supposed to have either of those things. They're supposed to interpret the law as written, but they're not doing that. And, you know, Republican-appointed judges do it a lot better than Democrat-appointed judges, but it's not perfect. But and it's because the law schools are teaching this theory of the living constitution, and everybody learns it. They think that's what they're supposed to do. And so, you know, in the defense of those judges, that's how they taught the law was supposed to work, but it's not true. And so the law schools have to bear a lot of blame for the mess that we're in this area.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, as great as my law school was and other things, this is what, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, when I went through law school, that's exactly what they taught. And had I not had a better foundation actually going through your constitutional law class, Mike Ferris, in high school as a homeschool student, because listeners will know that Mike was formerly also the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, that grounded me to understand what was actually going on and be able to say, well, wait a minute, law school isn't teaching this correctly. And that's what we need for future litigants and for judges, of course. So much more could be said on this. But Michael Ferris, really appreciate your time, General Counsel for the NRB. You can follow them on X at NRB Association, and really great historic win for the NRB and also for AFA. So we appreciate, of course, as well, Abe Hamilton III and our General Counsel here. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And, you know, so we've been talking about all of these legal cases and the forum selecting and the forum shopping, and then even Trump using executive orders rather than Congress having implementing or clarifying legislation. I think conservatives as a whole need to step back, as Mike Ferris in the last segment wisely pointed out, to say that we are originalists and that it's not just the outcome that we prefer by any sort of method. It's ultimately the preservation of our separation of powers and our limited specific powers that we give on the federal level, but then also limited being the key word. Not all powers are granted to the federal government. The Ninth and Tenth Amendment specifically say that only the specific limited powers are given to the federal government, and then all others are reserved to the states or to we the people. Government doesn't actually have all authority to do anything and everything that it wants to on any level, and we need to return to a proper understanding of government power in our nation and understand that we as individuals are practicing self-government. We the people have given limited authority to our government to operate specifically to preserve and protect the rights that God gives us, not that the government gives us. And so we have to, before we even approach an isolated topic, like the NPR case, for example, that we talked about at the top, I was talking to a reporter yesterday about that case, and, you know, kind of the initial reaction from the conservative side was, well, of course Trump should win, and nobody's, you know, entitled to taxpayer money to spout leftist views. And while, sure, I may agree with that generally, you have to go back and actually peel the layers and say what's being argued, where is the foundation in the principle of this, and what is the proper outcome in terms of precedent. And if we don't do that, and we don't have advocates, meaning lawyers in this instance, but even court of public opinion advocates like you and I mean, you have a voice in your network, whether that's just friends and family, it's in your church, it's in your sphere of influence, it's on your own social media. We have to be more grounded in principle and in truth, ultimately, and in principle of what our U.S. Constitution stands for if we're going to advocate properly on these issues. And so we have to first understand what our Constitution says and be principled in order to then understand what posture we should take on all of these cases that arise, on the news topics and the politics. And that's what this show attempts at least to provide, is some of that clarity to say, okay, there are all of these news of the day issues, but where's the principle and how do we return to originalism? And this isn't saying that, you know, it's sort of a lame defense that we're just sitting here kind of defending this ground and we're not pressing forward for outcomes that we prefer because all we're doing is defending. I'm not certainly not suggesting that. We need to aggressively defend, be on the offensive to defend principle. And I think Mike Ferris put it well when he said, you know, we need to fight fire with fire, but we need to do that very carefully and still confined to the contours and the parameters of principle. But one of the other things that he mentioned that is so important is something that I wrote about very recently on the dangerous rise of judicial supremacy. Because Mike put this so well, that originalism teaches that all legislative authority is vested in Congress, all executive authority is vested in a president, and the judiciary was designed originally, and in the text of the Constitution, it still is. It doesn't matter how long ago the Constitution was signed, ratified, framed, all of that. It's not a living document. It still says what it said at the inception of this country. That's still the truth of our government system. And we can't allow it to be recreated through people who intentionally misinterpret and misapply it. And the left does this all the time, intentionally, and they'll invoke a part of the Constitution and they'll intentionally twist it just to say, well, you can't argue against the Constitution, but it's a facade. And it's something that they can't credibly actually appeal to because they're not taking the entire thing in context. And so when I wrote about this, and you can read the article at afa.net, and just search for this title, The Dangerous Rise of Judicial Supremacy, because I write, for years, federal judges have increasingly assumed a power that the Constitution never gave them, the authority to impose national policies with the stroke of a pen. As Mike put it, this is living in a nation of politics as law instead of actually the rule of law. And the case that I talk about in this is the whole nationwide injunction issue that the Supreme Court recently took up in the context of Trump and his national birthright citizenship executive order. But the more important issue, even then, the immigration topic and that issue, is this whole idea of nationwide injunctions that a single federal district judge can simply block a policy or an order that is legitimately under the purview of the executive. An executive order is simply a formalized executive action. And if the executive is vested with the power to enact that order, then it is not for any judge to second guess that just simply based on a plaintiff arguing, well, this harms me in some kind of fashion. I mean, every policy, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or anywhere in between, will have consequences. But that's the consequence of elections. That shouldn't be an issue that's litigated in a court and second-guessed, the policy second-guessed, by a judge whose only power is to simply interpret the law as written and faithfully apply the U.S. Constitution. I mean, if we were doing this correctly and federal judges were confined to their limited authority, they would only issue rulings on actually federal issues. And you have to go back then in the U.S. Constitution and look at what limited powers are actually given to Congress to legislate. Because at the beginning of this segment, I was saying, I mean, Congress doesn't have all authority over all subject matter. They can't just say, you know, hey, we don't like how education is being run, and so we're going to legislate on this. We're going to, you know, appropriate funding for anything that we want. They're actually limited. Now, they don't think that they are. Even Republicans, by and large anymore, don't think that they're actually limited, but they are. If you look at Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, it specifies the specific subject matter that the federal Congress has authority to legislate on. There are so many issues and topics and subject matter that are outside of those very specific subject matter. So then where do those go? What about those powers? Well, that's either given to the state or to we the people. Our government should not be able to legislate on literally anything that it wants to, especially the federal level. Well, why? Because we are 50 laboratories of democracy. The state of Florida is going to look different than the state of California, and that's okay. We don't have to have a uniform rule on every single subject matter. This is why you can be like me and choose to leave the incredibly leftist progressive state of Colorado because you don't like where their policies are going, and move to the free state of Florida because you like where Florida is going and the conservatism that it champions. This is the point of living in the United States. Now, it's not to say that what Colorado is doing is actually constitutional on the state level. And I'm talking, of course, about the Colorado Constitution, the broader implications of liberty, the specific limited powers that the U.S. Constitution recognizes are given to the federal government and to the states, right? So it's not to say that some states should be able to be as leftist as they want to, but it's saying that we recognize in this country that there are going to be differences, and not everything is determined by a federal Congress or adjudicated by a federal court. And we want to limit that. We have to limit that if we are going to advance individual freedom and genuinely preserve self-government. So the problem and the dangerous rise of judicial supremacy is this whole idea that we can go and forum shop, the left can with their 287 cases now against the Trump administration, go forum shop, find one federal judge that will issue a nationwide injunction or a nationwide ruling that will handicap all of the conservative states and say, well, this has to be a uniform rule. That's not the Constitution we actually live under. And like it or not, the left still lives under the U.S. Constitution. Conservatives just have to enforce it. So go read this article, The Dangerous Rise of Judicial Supremacy, for more. We're already out of time. I love talking about this. And if you have any questions, comments, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. See you tomorrow and also Friday. Make sure to always tune in to On Demand, our AFR exclusive podcast at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.